Session number 17695, Sergeant Major Frederick Beadle, Reel 5.
Sergeant Major Beadle, Reel 5. You're explaining about the double apron. What did you do to turn a single apron into a double apron?
A single apron fence is a fence going out from what you are defending in the form of a series of V's which look like aprons. And then make it a double apron fence, you come round the other side, the main fence in the upright posts, the long posts, and do exactly the same thing as you did on the forward part of the fencing, thus making it a double apron fence.
How wide would a single apron be? You know, what would the distance be between the main posts and the smaller posts in front of them?
I would say about 6 yards. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
So it was a double apron.
Not as much as that.
Not as much.
No. About 3 yards. One apron going out one way and 3 yards the other way, front and back.
Yes. So if it was double apron, it would be about six yards.
6 yards, yes. Yeah. Which, if you can imagine, it's quite a way, really.
Yeah. Was it a very time-consuming business, putting up a... Was it a time-consuming business, putting up an apron?
Well, it was, yes, because... it's something you didn't do every day of the week, and you have to know how to do the job, first of all. You'd have to know, as an NCO, how to instruct other people to do the job, because they would have a section of people to do it, and each man would have a different job to do in order to formulate the fence, in the same way as piling arms, if you remember, is making a pile of one's rifles if you're going to leave them standing while you go and have a rest or do what have you. And with piling arms, there's a number of men to do the job. They have their different numbers, and each number does a different job in order to get the rifles in their pile.
So they're stacked and they don't fall over.
That's right. Yeah.
Were there any other obstacles that you could make use of besides wire aprons when you were protecting a defensive position?
No, I can't think of any offhand just like that.
When you were digging a trench, you said it was that you had to drop down into it. Roughly how deep and how wide would a trench be?
It depended on whether you thought you were going to stay in that position for any length of time. If you wasn't going to stay there any length of time, it's only a very temporary thing, then all you would do is to dig down far enough to you lay down in it and still fire, lay it in the trench, say, what, a foot deep? Something like that. But if you was going to stay there, like the First World War, they were there for 4 years in some of them, then one dug a very deep trench. If you see pictures of people in these trenches, you see the trenches are higher than the people, or deeper than the people, I should say.
Were you digging trenches like that in India?
We were taught how to do it, yes.
You're taught?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I did a course as late as 1935, I suppose, in trench warfare, and how to dig a trench and rivet it with sandbags.
Where was that done? Was that at Bareilly?
That was at Bareilly, yes. Yeah.
Who taught you those things? Was it done within the battalion?
The system in those days was they would send an NCO to somewhere, a school of training somewhere, and they'd get him back, and he would take over under the officers, of course, the training of people in that particular subject. Like a PT course. There was a PT school in India. That was all, only a PT school. There was no PT people anywhere else, only at the school.
So it was all within the battalion? That's
the instructions were all within the battalion, so, having been trained as a specialist.
For instance, Cherby Holt, who you know.
Yes.
He went on a PT course and came back, and he was an assistant physical training instructor.
When you were doing the tactical training, you mentioned that you did dig trenches in the First World War style. The First World War was characterised by massive use of artillery. Did you have exercises in which artillery was a feature, or in which it was assumed?
No. No, never. Well, I say no a bit too hastily. There was a troop of artillery in Brayley, although we saw very little of them. They were a few miles from us. And on one or two occasions when we went off for our annual camp, they did join in with us. But otherwise, never saw anything of them.
Was that annual camp just battalion plus the artillery, or was it sometimes?
It was just the battalion.
How far away did you go from Brayley to go on annual camp?
Well, we used to march it, of course. It took us about 5 3 about 12 to 15 miles, I suppose.
What was the ground like on your exercise area?
Flat. Flat, hard. It was... We'd be going over land that had been farmed, of course. So you'd have paddy fields, sugar canes, all that type of thing, agriculturally.
Do you think that the troops actually enjoyed going on this annual camp or not?
I think the majority of them did. Yes, it got you out of the camp for a week or a fortnight, however long you was going to be away. It was somewhere different. It was a more active life than being in barracks, because you was out doing an exercise each day, no days off.
How long were you there for your annual camp?
A fortnight in most cases, but I did go on one for a week on one occasion. I think the brigade camp we did was only a week, but again, my memory fails me as to exactly how long it took.
You were saying that you spent some 4 years at Brayley. Was that the normal length of time you'd spend in a post?
Yes, it was. Yes. It was a normal length in most cases, except for when you were somewhere that was a bit more attractive. Then the situation seemed to be different, because we went to Dinapore in December 1935 and left there in 1938. So you see, that was a little bit less.
Was that from Brayley? You went from Brayley to Dinapore?
Yes.
Yes.
No. No, sorry. No, we went from Brayley to Rasbach.
That was for 1 year, then?
1 year at Rasbach.
Yes, right.
And then from Rasbach to Brayley.
Right. And then off to Dinapore later.
Sorry, no.
From Rasbach to Dinapore.
I was out with the battalion there from 29 to 39. Mm. During that time, we were at Barrackpore, Brayley, Rasbach, Dinapore, Lahore.
Right. Now, you said that the three men who committed suicide at Brayley were bored, essentially. You implied.
Well, one could only assume that, of course.
Yeah. Did you know any of them at all?
Personally, no. Yeah. I knew them as members of the battalion, but not as friends. Again, it was a case... if I was in A Company, I would know all the A Company people thoroughly, but I wouldn't know who was in B Company or C Company. Again, you sort of gathered in your own little family, so to speak.
I mean, was the company a big family, or was it really the platoon that was the main...
No, the company.
Family feeling, the company.
Intercompany competition was very active.
Did it have any effect on morale when these men killed themselves? Was there a...
No, not really. To be quite honest, I'm almost ashamed to say so, people didn't take much notice of it. What worried a lot of them, if they were in the funeral party, was that was another suit of KD they got to clean. It's a terrible thing to say, but such was the case. Probably better that way, anyway.
Now, this was the 1930s, and there were some rather dramatic events going on in the Far East and also in Europe. Were you aware of political developments in the wider world?
No, we weren't, really. We had no radio in those days. Not in India, we didn't. They had them at home. We didn't buy newspapers. The only thing we saw as far as the news was concerned was the news on cinema news.
Do you remember what you got? Did you get Pathé News or anything like
that's
that?
That's right. Yes. We used to get the same films out there as what you had in England, but a long time afterwards.
Yes.
Ganga Din was one of the films we saw. Rather amusing, really, because we watched that at this particular brigade camp, and our commanding officer in those days was a Colonel Dean. So he was always called Ganga Dean. So we went to the cinema, and he was there present as well. When it came to that part where it says, "You're a better man than I am, Ganga Dean," everybody came in, of course.
Did you see much of officers in India, or were they still living
no.
in a world of their own?
More or less, yes. It was their way of life, I suppose. I don't know. I don't quite know how to put it, but I think they could have been or more friendly and still have respect. But we saw very little of them, really.
Did they take a leading part when you went off to camp and did your tactical exercises?
Yes. Yes. They didn't always take any notice of what you had to say. And 9 times out of 10, they proved themselves wrong. But there was something... I can't put my finger on it as far as the officers were concerned. We didn't see as much of them as I think we ought to have done. Consequently, we didn't really know them as well as we ought to know them. Because, in my opinion, if you're going on to active service, the better you know the officers in charge, the better you feel about it. At least you know what to do yourself.
What do you think are the qualities of a good officer, that, you know, the desirable qualities that make somebody a good officer, apart from being able to get to know the troops and let them know him? What other things does he need?
Well, I think to be a good officer, he's got to think of his platoon or whatever is his command as a family of children. Put them right by word of mouth. I'd have to think about that.
Yeah. Well, what about an NCO? What are the qualities of a good NCO?
Well, I found as an NCO that I got by all right because I did punch up my subjects. I put them over as well as I could. As far as the men were concerned, if I was their section commander or their platoon commander, I think I always treated them fairly. I showed no favouritism towards one or another. On the other hand, if they were playing up at any time, I was strong enough to have them punished in whatever way was necessary. And lastly, I suppose, to be understanding. If a chap starts playing up one way or the other, it's not according to his nature. It's nice to take him at one side and ask him what goes on and have a little chat about it and sort it out verbally if one can. I think that counts a lot.
Was the discipline very strict? Was the discipline very strict?
Oh, very strict, yes, of course. Yes. Yes, so it's... there was the rules and regulations, and one had to comply with them. As far as I was concerned, it was a nice, easy way of life. You knew if you broke the rules, and if you broke the rules, you knew what you were set in for. And that's all there was to it.
You were saying that you got the Pathé newsreels. Did they have any impact on your thinking about prospects of the future
at all.
The time?
No. Not at all. No. That was something, again, which could probably have come under the officer's jurisdiction. They should have had up-to-date information on what was happening in Germany, let us say, for instance, and what was the conclusion of all his antics and what we should be doing about it in order to take action one way or the other, whichever he is doing. Now, I think officers could have been trained up in up-to-date news, if we call it that, which they could pass on to their particular sections, companies or what have you. But quite honestly, I only knew a bit more about it than most of the chaps out in India, because I was due to finish my coloured engagement on the 10th of October 1939, and I applied for and was granted a vocational training period, which had to be done within my service time. So I came home in March 1939 in order to get 6 months training in before the 10th of October. I did this 6 months training in sheet metal work.
Where did you do that?
At Wadden, which is it was a government training centre which backed on to the aerodrome of Croydon. It was very well organised. I was in civvy billets, which was great. And by being at home that much earlier than the other lads out in India, of course I got all the up-to-date news and was quite surprised at some of it. But,
What was it particularly that surprised you?
Well, it was the way that Hitler was strutted around and getting away with everything, and nobody would do anything about it. It was just fantastic, really.
You've been away from England for 9 years or so.
I hadn't.
You came back?
No, I came home on leave in 1936.
Oh, I see. So you've been
I had
back.
6 months leave then.
Right.
Which, to me, was a bit of a disaster, really.
Why was that?
Well, 6 months is a long time. Now, I was a very keen NCO up to going on leave. Now, 6 months was just too long. It was long enough to forget about the army and not really want to go back again. And it was long enough to have a girlfriend, which I hadn't had before, having been in India from a boy. So I just didn't want to go back. When I did get back there, I thought, well, I'll see if I can get some courses to sort of get me into swing again. But I wasn't really happy. As far as I was concerned, that 6 months was too long and it was a disaster. In reflection, I would have done better without it.
Would it have been all right to have had a shorter time, 3 months or something
yeah.
like that?
If, say, they had a month after 2 years or something like that,
yes.
That would be more sensible. But to have 6 months, if you could imagine it, 6 months leave, 6 months with nothing to do, it was disastrous, really.
When you were in India, what did you keep in touch with home by letter?
By letter, yes. Yeah. Well, of course, it took a long time to get to India in those days. It was 3 weeks on a troop ship. And I think the mail boat took nearly as long. I wouldn't be sure about that. About 18 days, I think. I don't know. And if you wrote home, to get a reply to the letter you'd written and posted would take about 6 weeks, I suppose.
Yes. I mean, when they wrote from home, did your correspondence include anything about political life, or was it mainly family business that they were...
I got very little in the way of letters from home, except from one sister. Oh. And, I mean, she wasn't interested in what was happening. She was more interested in getting the living for herself. She is in service as a maid, and she used to write to me from there. But, otherwise, I didn't hear very much from home.
Now, you mentioned you had your service in Barrackpore, then you went to Bareilly, and then I think after Bareilly you went to Rasmac.
Yes.
Tell me about Rasmac.
Well, as I've told you about our first exercise with the Gurkhas...
Picketing the Heights. Picketing the Heights.
That's right, yes. Yeah. To get up there, we train... We travelled by train to Banu, which was a hutted camp. It was awful there because there was about 5 or 6 inches of dust everywhere that you walked on. And it was so bad that your hair was just stiff most of the time. So I had all my hair shaved off anyway to get rid of that. It was more economical. And we marched from Badu up to Rasmac. 5 days, to the best of my memory, we marched. It was all by road. There was a good road up to Rasmac. And you camped on sites that had been occupied before. Now, this is where we got our initial training. The site, you would be lumbered with big bricks and bits of wall here and bits of wall there. And arriving there and occupying the area, your first job was to rebuild the wall around you for defence should you be attacked.
How high would the wall be?
4 feet.
So it's a breastwork.
It was just brick on brick.
Yes.
About... 18 inches, 2 feet, by 4 feet, 4 feet 6. No definite measurement there. It was just a case of having something around you for safety. The other safety thing that we had there was our rifles. We had to chain them to us, to ourselves, if we slept under the area that night.
Did you have patrols out at night?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We... Well, for instance, one camp, I think it was about the third camp, if my memory serves me right, companies were taken in turn doing the pickets.
Yes.
And when we arrived in the camp, a section that was due to go out in a picket looked at the height and just refused to go. And A Company was the next ones in line, and I was the unfortunate NCO with 12 who went up on this particular height.
How high was it?
Oh, again, I wouldn't like to say.
Do you have any idea of roughly how long it took you to get up on top?
Can't remember. It was a damn long way. I'm a bit daunting after marching all day. This was going on sort of 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We've been on our feet all day.
So you marched about 15 miles, something like that?
About that, yes, yeah. About 12 to 15.
And then you had to go up to the heights.
That's right.
What did you do when you got there, up on top?
Very little. You were there in case.
Yes.
So what you did, again, it was brickwork round it. It's a pity I haven't got that photograph to show you. And you'd have two men... looking in different directions, obviously, for any encroachment, and the rest of them would be just resting. And you'd exercise them in the 204 officer situation with a sociable neddy guard.
Would you do that all night?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Had you done a lot of training in night patrolling and night work?
Oh, we had done, yes. Yes. Oh, yes, a very memorable one, in which strikes me straight away when you say that, was again at Brayley. Everything happened at Brayley.
Yes.
But marching onto a particular site at night, we had this with a compass and a piece of white handkerchief or something on the back of the neck of the chap you sent out in front, because you did so many paces to this compass bearing, so many paces to that compass bearing, and then you should finish up in the end, however many you did, on the spot where they tried to guide you.
So it's night navigation.
Yes.
Yes. Did that work?
Well, more by luck than judgment. When it was my turn to do this, I finished up about a yard away from the corner of an old tin building, and my section consisted then of about 8 people, I think. And I turned around and I said, well, that's what I make it. And as I said that, this officer stepped out from under the dark of the building there and said, well, you've done very well there. This is where it was. So it was more my luck than judgment. For instance, one part of it, we had to go past a big bushy defence thing, and I lined the chap up on this line, this side of it, then told him to run round the other side. and then I walked round and he went out and I got him again on there. And to get so close was fantastic, really. The officer you might have heard of, I don't know, but it was a Major IEF Campbell. It's too far back. He was a terrific officer, actually. Now, he was my idea of a good officer.
What was so ideal about him, then? Describe him.
He knew what he was doing, he knew where he was going to go, and there was nothing going to get in his way. He was a great chap. He, most unfortunate ending, he was transferred to the PT school in Aldershot as an officer instructor. And he died with appendicitis.
That's very bad luck.
This is the type of chap he is. He was a brevet major when he came to the battalion. And within a very short space of time, he was running a course for lance corporals to see their efficiency for full corporal, and a course for full corporal to sergeant. He got all the sport going, he got us together, we built a running track under his instruction. He got the whole battalion on PT. I don't know if he invented it or whether he got it from elsewhere, but we were all issued with sticks, like broomsticks, about 3 feet long. And all the battalion were left going out each morning doing these stick exercises, they were called. But that's the type of chap he was. He got things going.
Was he from the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry originally?
Yes. Yes, he was. Well, if you went into the gymnasium in Aldershot now, you'd still find his name up there.
Was he your company commander?
No. I was personally with him in the NCO's course from lance corporal to corporal. And although I never told any of the lads this, he interviewed every one of the people on that course, told them their faults and where they should be aiming for, what they should not do at the end of the course. When it was my turn to go in there, one of the things he said to me was, by 1938, I hope to come back to this battalion and be the battalion commander, and nothing would please me more other than to see you as my RSM, which I thought was a great...
Very high compliment.
Yeah. He never lived long enough to do that, but I bet he would have been there. He was just that type of chap.
When did you get your first promotion then? It sounds as though by the time you went to RASMAC, you were already an NCO.
That was in Borrelia again.
Yes.
What happened with the promotion in those days was I left the band and was posted to A Company as a private soldier, of course. I studied as much as I could in those days, and then thought to myself, it's time I was going to be an NCO, if I'm ever going to be one at all. So I had a word with the sergeant major of the company and told him that I would like to be considered for promotion. I didn't have a clue how I was going to get it.
What did he say?
And he said, all right, so come and see the company commander tomorrow morning. So I went along to the commander.